Hello, everyone. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host today, Rob Moore, here with the lovely Lamia Gibson at the helm as well.
Hello, hello. Good morning.
Good day. Be sure to visit us at www.animalvoices.ca, and you can learn more about our guests and post comments and questions for our shows. Today's topic is helping troubled teens with veganism, the link between food and behavior.
I'm so excited about this show.
I think you're going to get more excited as you hear a little bit more.
Oh, okay, I'll let you go then.
That's good. I'm glad you're pumped. The reason I'm doing this show is because we had Dr. T. Colin Campbell on the show in October talking about the link between dairy intake and early menarche in girls, or when they get the first period, which is much earlier than it used to be, and how this early and increased exposure to estrogen potentially leads to breast cancer later in life. I highly recommend you check out that show. Earlier this year, I read an article in the Toronto Star about how the increase in violence in young girls is also linked to early puberty. You see how the chain keeps going. And the article said, girls who hit puberty at age 8 or 9 are not equipped emotionally or intellectually to deal with sexual attention from men and are at risk of early sexual behavior and teen pregnancy. The resulting confusion can cause severe anger and aggression. So this begs the question, I was thinking, that are the foods we're eating not only contributing to disease later in life, but psychological problems as well? So I asked Dr. Campbell if anyone was connecting the dots on this and studying this phenomenon, and he immediately recommended today's guest, Dr. Antonia Demas. And she is going to reveal some fascinating things about her month-long study at a school for troubled young males from the streets. And these are kids who committed crimes and were sent to the Bay Point School in Florida by the courts, and they did have problems with aggression, poor grades, and all that. They were challenged to go vegan for 1 month as part of this study. So what happened? Did their grades go up? Did they start to excel in their sports? Did they get along better with others? Well, you're going to have to stick around and find out. But I'll read you a bit of a journal entry, the first journal entry from one of the students named Willie. He wrote, "Today I'm starting a new experiment. I am very skeptical about this experiment. I am going to be a vegan vegetarian for 1 month. I think this is not going to affect my body in any way. I hope I survive through this experiment. I really hope the food don't be nasty. I really am skeptical about this." And if you just can't wait to hear how Willie did, you can go to animalvoices.ca and read his and several other journals of the students who went through this experiment. And I tell you, it is a fascinating, inspiring, and uplifting read. But I'm not going to give everything away. Antonia will give us all the details about that, as well as on her Food is Elementary curriculum that teaches children about food, nutrition, culture, and healthy living, and also the Food Studies Institute, which is devoted to changing the health destinies of children through proper nutrition and education. Changing their destinies. Love that. First, the news. A few articles about the oceans and things that are linked to the ocean from the Times Online. The UN has warned the world's governments that humankind's exploitation of the sea could be passing the point of no return. A report by the United Nations Environment Program found that more than half of the world's fish stocks are being exploited to their full extent, with nearly a quarter suffering from overfishing. Meanwhile, pollution, litter, and deep-sea drilling are all reaching into the depths of a marine environment hitherto preserved from the hand of man. In the Central Pacific, the study found, there is now up to 6 pounds of marine litter to every 1 pound of plankton. Elsewhere, there are around 46,000 pieces of plastic litter for every square mile of the world's oceans. According to the report, just 1% of the world's 3.5 million fishing boats are thought to be large industrial vessels, but the giant loads they trawl from the deep sea account for around 60% of all the fish caught on the planet. Industrial fishing has helped to drive down the world's stocks of tuna, cod, swordfish, and marlin by as much as 90% in the last century. Adding to the strain on the oceans, the UN estimated that nearly $10 billion of fish are caught illegally each year, up to 30% of which is taken from unregulated waters. Illegal longline fishing also kills more than 300,000 seabirds every year, including 100,000 albatrosses. 19 out of 21 albatross species are now threatened with extinction. And I think perhaps someone should send that article to the International Whaling Commission from the Associated Press. A slim majority of nations on the International Whaling Commission voted Sunday in support of a resumption of commercial whaling. But pro-whaling nations still lack the numbers needed to overturn a 20-year-old ban. The resolution declares that the moratorium on commercial whaling was meant to be temporary and is no longer needed. The Japanese applauded the result. Both Japan and Iceland kill whales for scientific research, which critics call a sham, and sell the carcasses. Norway ignores the moratorium and openly conducts commercial whaling. Environmental groups have accused developing nations of voting with Japan in return for money for fisheries projects, which Japan and those countries have repeatedly denied. Caribbean tourism officials have said they are concerned that their country's support of whaling might lead travelers to boycott the region. And there's a hint. Caribbean tourism, boycott, boycott Caribbean. You get the picture. And I think we should also forward that article to John Mackey, the president of Whole Foods, because while he really has brought animal welfare issues into the spotlight, I think he's still missing the big picture from USA Today. Customers craving fresh crustaceans will have to look beyond Whole Foods Market after the natural foods grocery chain decided Thursday to stop selling live lobsters and crabs on the grounds that it's inhumane. The Austin-based grocer spent 7 months studying the sale of live lobsters from ship to supermarket aisle, trying to determine whether the creatures suffer along the way. Ultimately, Whole Foods said they could not ensure the creatures are treated with respect and compassion. In making its decision, Whole Foods pointed to a November report from the European Food Safety Authority Animal Health and Welfare Panel that concluded that all decapod crustaceans, including lobsters and crabs, appear to have some degree of awareness, feel pain, and can learn. From now on, Whole Foods will only sell frozen raw and cooked lobster products at its more than 180 stores, and the chain will only deal with suppliers meeting their standards for humane treatment, handling, and processing. Whole Foods leaders will reconsider the decision if they see evidence that it's possible to ensure lobsters and crabs are treated humanely throughout the supply chain. From the Toronto Star, a second Prince Edward Island farm has been placed under a quarantine order as a precautionary measure as authorities investigate the finding of an H5 avian flu virus in a domestic goose in that province. An official of the Canadian Food Inspection Agency said the move was taken when investigators learned there was traffic of people and perhaps poultry between the two farms, which both had free-range backyard flocks. Ottawa-based Dr. Jim Clark said no birds from the second farm have displayed signs of illness, and for the time being, authorities have not ordered their destruction. From the Independent out of the UK, hundreds of black bears in Canada faced slaughter after the British Army abandoned a trial of synthetic fur for the guard's ceremonial headgear. When speaking of the bear hunt, the Independent wrote, "If the animal is fortunate, it will die quickly from a shot to the head before having its head and paws severed as trophies and the skin sold to a fur auctioneer. In the past 5 years alone, 494 of those pelts have been sold at a cost of £321,000 to the British Ministry of Defence. Yesterday, the MOD were accused by animal welfare campaigners of perpetuating the annual slaughter of 10,000 Canadian black bears, many of whom die in pain from botched kills by fee-paying trophy sportsmen. The Army said the trial of synthetic fur had failed because they got waterlogged on rainy days, and senior officers complained that the man-made hats lacked the life and, quote, bounce of real bear skin." And what about the life and bounce of real bears? Has anyone thought of that? Next, from the San Francisco Chronicle, Anshul Gunwani wants to open a restaurant in Mumbai, India, but he's afraid it would be attacked, not by terrorists, but by vegetarians. And in North America, they're considered the same thing, don't you know? The approximately 10-square-mile area of Gunwani is, quote, a totally veg zone, said Shambhu Pujari, manager of a vegetarian restaurant there. "True vegetarians don't want any association with non-vegetarianism," Pujari said. "Even if a hand that touched meat touches the vessel which contains vegetarian food, they will see it as a contamination. While many Hindus are vegetarian, many are not. but vegetarian extremism, as Pujari puts it, has become particularly pointed as practiced by some Hindu Brahmins and the Jain religious community. Staunch Brahmins who inhabit the highest caste under India's complex caste system believe eating meat robs them of their spiritual purity. Devout Jains even wear masks to avoid breathing bacteria and refuse to eat garlic and other roots as uprooting them kills insects. Diet has become a particularly explosive issue, with Islamic leaders fighting to prevent the sale of pork in Muslim areas, Hindu parties crying out for a ban on cow slaughter, and Christian groups insisting on their right to eat meat. Over the years, these differences have turned Mumbai into a ghettoized city, with Muslims, Sikhs, Christians, Jains, and others often keeping other faiths out of the housing complexes in which they live, which I talked about last week. Sanjay Narang, a local restaurateur who owns the Roti chain of restaurants that serve northern Indian fare such as tandoori chicken and Rogan Josh, tried to open one of his restaurants near a Jain temple. It was very unwelcome, Narang told the local press, and members of the Jain community living nearby spat on guests and pelted them with pebbles. Can you imagine us standing outside McDonald's and pelting customers with pebbles and things like that?
I think the police would come and arrest us.
I think so. It's funny. For those of you out there who maybe didn't get the email, we just had an article in Satya magazine that featured our show and many other vegan or animal advocacy radio shows out there. And I think it was Bob Linden who runs, I can't remember the name of his show right now, but he said it's interesting if he's on the street protesting, he's considered, you know, possibly a terrorist or a nuisance. Mm-hmm. But if he's given a microphone and a radio show, he's all of a sudden a celebrity.
Yeah.
Doing the exact same thing.
Yeah.
So it's just an interesting little.
It's all how we see things and the vise through which we see them, the view.
Definitely. I just got one more news item from news.com out of Australia. Banner-wielding animal rights protesters swarmed into a restaurant serving cat meat in the southern Chinese city of Shenzhen and forced it to shut, Xinhua News Agency said. I cannot go on with my business and I will not sell cat meat anymore, the restaurant owner was quoted as saying, though he defended his trade by saying eating cat in Guangdong province was a tradition. Many Chinese, particularly in the south, believe dogs and cats are good warming foods to eat during the winter. But China is developing a nascent animal rights movement as more people raise pets, which during the country's communist heyday was frowned upon as a bourgeois activity. So I thought that was interesting, although it still compartmentalizes animals into these are the ones we love and these are the ones we love to eat.
Mm-hmm.
It's all just a cultural and industrial invention,
mm-hmm.
in my mind. All right, well, you're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're talking about helping troubled teens with veganism, the link between food and behavior, with Dr. Antonia Damas. You won't want to miss this one. Stick around. Antonia, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, there's so much to talk about, I almost don't know where to start. But let's begin at the Bay Point School in Florida, and it's for troubled young males. Could you first tell us, I just want you to give us the environment of that school. What does that mean by troubled young males?
It means these are young men who've been sent to the school by the court rather than being sent to jail. They've committed crimes, and because the prisons are so full of people and we don't have space for them, and because these are young offenders, they're sent to this school, which really does care about trying to educate the students and give them a chance to overcome some of the obstacles that they've been facing. So it's a way for them to get an education in a controlled environment, also get counseling and hopefully life skills that will make it so they won't resort to a life of crime.
And how did you come to be involved with this school?
I was involved a number of years ago. I was working in Miami. I was working in a number of the elementary schools, especially the ones that serve a minority population. And a colleague knew the director of the Bay Point School and invited me to work with them. They wanted me to develop a culinary arts program, which is something they used to have a while ago, but because the people who were running it weren't really trained in nutrition or in cooking, they decided that it really wasn't an educational program in the way they wanted it to be. So they put it on hold and wanted to revive it but bring a nutrition element in. So that's why I was invited to bring back a culinary arts program with a nutrition focus. I was also asked to help revise the menu. The boys at Bay Point eat all their meals at the school, so their food is completely controlled by the school environment. They don't have access to outside food or to just going outside the school on their own. So I started working with the cooks and students. We formed a culinary club, and I found that they were extremely interested in learning nutrition and cooking, healthful cooking, and very cooperative and curious about it. Most of the staff had diet-related diseases.
Like what kind of diet-related diseases?
They had serious heart disease and diabetes. Diabetes was very apparent. Obesity. And they weren't feeling that well themselves, so they were quite curious to learn about how food affects their physical health and how specific nutrients affect different parts of their body. And I was giving them this information through hands-on interaction with different foods and discussion and experiments about the role nutrients play in human health and mental health as well as physical health. The students were extremely receptive and had never really considered that food might have something to do with their anger. So we were having a very enjoyable time, and I was getting such cooperation that I decided to explore doing a pilot study whereby the students would go on a vegan plant-based diet for a number of weeks to see if anything would change. So I approached the administration to bring up this idea, and they said, sure, we would support it if the students want to sign up to do this.
First of all, has anyone done a kind of study like this before?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay, go on.
And the food was typical institutional food. It was a lot of fried foods, heavy on the meat, white bread, very few fresh fruits and vegetables, a lot of dairy, a lot of sugary drinks. So it was the typical institutional food. And what happens in settings like that is food is a major distraction. So usually people who are basically incarcerated, which these kids were, even though it was a school, not a prison, but they couldn't leave voluntarily. So what happens is food becomes something to look forward to, and people tend to overeat. So they were consuming a lot of these very heavy calories and doing it out of boredom, as if not anything else. And without the nutrition background, it's hard to understand why the food may not make you feel good. So what I was providing was the information about food and nutrition, so they were seeing that there was a connection, and I was also teaching them how to cook, so they developed a lot of cooking skills, and we were tasting lots of different fresh items that most of these students had never had before.
And, so, and were you dealing just with vegan food, no animal products at all?
I was dealing only with plant-based food.
Okay,
yes.
Gotcha.
So I took the students on a series of field trips. We went to a natural grocery store where they had prepared tastings of different products for us so the students could taste a variety of different foods that they didn't even know existed. And then we went to a fruit and vegetable and spice park in Miami that gives tours, and we got a tour and they got to sample things straight from the tree or shrub that it's grown on. So, for example, they were able to taste 20 different varieties of grapefruit. And believe it or not, even though this was Florida, a lot of these students had never had fresh grapefruit before.
Hmm.
So the assumptions that people just because they live in a place that produces a food, eat that food. If you're poor and if you aren't exposed, then it's not safe to assume that they've had variety in their diet. The average person is said to eat the same 10 foods over and over again. And that's especially true if you're committed to a fast food or institutional type of diet. So these kids were learning about foods that they never knew existed, and they were learning how to cook them, and they were tasting them and evaluating them and keeping journals about them. They really enjoyed it.
I imagine that that's a much better way to get children, teens, interested in vegetables by doing these kind of field trips, as you say, taking them, I guess, to the source of how they're grown and introducing them to all these different varieties to show them the diversity of what's out there.
Exactly. We're motivated by pleasure and pleasurable experiences, not by unpleasant experiences. And these kids really did enjoy that. We also went to an organic farm, and they got to pull up carrots straight from the ground. And again, the assumption that they know something about gardening at all, never mind organic gardening, you need to assume nothing when you're dealing with populations that have been deprived historically from some of these experiences. So they were having a great time. They were asking all kinds of questions. They liked the foods. I let them experiment with recipes. So when I approached them about going on a plant-based diet for 3.5 weeks, they were eager to try it. However, they thought that it wasn't really going to have any effect on anything. They thought, well, this will be another diversion to mm-hmm. pass the time.
And then a couple of people did write in their journals, like Rodney said, I'm not going to give up my meat for this stupid junk.
Yeah, in the beginning.
Yeah,
right.
So a couple of people, I think, may have been skeptical about the
whole
process.
They were very skeptical at first because they thought that this wasn't going to have any impact on them, and they thought that they couldn't live without eating meat all the time and that they'd become weak if they didn't have meat. However, they all kept journals, and so they were evaluating how they felt on a regular basis, and they were making that connection. And you're right, a lot of them started out with great skepticism, but by the end they were feeling so much better that they really had their minds open to the fact that when you eat a diet that mainly doesn't have any whole foods in it and is nutrient depleted, it's going to affect your energy level. It's going to affect your thinking ability. And I could tell them that over and over again, but it's like putting up a poster in a cafeteria. It's not going, they're not going to really understand it unless they experience it. So the most effective thing I could do was give them an opportunity to have firsthand experience with the changes that they were feeling in the way they thought and felt. And also the documentation of writing down in the journal. We were fortunate to get the cooperation of Miami Children's Hospital, who volunteered to do blood work on the students before the experiment began and afterwards. So we have some independent measures of what was happening to them physically. Also, because these students are monitored 24/7, any acting out incidences are recorded on a regular basis. The school has that strategy to document that down. So I was able to have access to that data, the behavior and acting out, if it changed during the time these students were eating differently.
So then, first of all, behaviorally, the students themselves, and you can see from their journal entries, and people can read some of the journal entries at animalvoices.ca, the students, they did start to feel better, not just physically, but mentally.
Exactly.
And so, like, give us some examples of what really happened during this study in terms of their mental health.
Well, they really had nutrients for, in some cases, the first time that were soaring through their arteries. When you think of eating a very dense meal full of saturated fat, our circulatory system delivers oxygen and nutrients to every single organ in our body. It's the delivery system. And if you're slowing that delivery system down by eating a very heavy saturated fat item, then even if you're getting, if you're eating nutrients in the mix, it, the delivery system's going to be operating at a limited capability. So what happened was by drinking 8 glasses of water, which was part of what they had to agree to, so they drank at least 8 glasses of water a day, and eating nutrient-rich foods, almost immediately it was as though an IV full of wonderful things was going through their bodies, because they were getting this saturation of all the nutrients that they typically didn't get, and they were hydrated, so they were getting enough water in their system, whereas before they were getting a very low level of nutrients, and it was operating, their blood was flowing at a much slower pace because of all the junk that was in it. And almost immediately, their energy level just increased dramatically. They did better on the sports field. They had so much more energy. Their faces cleared up. One of the almost immediate outcomes was they were no longer constipated, and they all were very aware of that because they were getting fiber. So everything improved. They were getting better grades. They were thinking more clearly. One of the unexpected outcomes was once they realized how differently they felt and how much better they felt, they wanted to share this with other people. So, for example, one of the students was about to get a pass because he was going to be released soon, and they try to transition them so they can get used to being at home. So they get a weekend pass right before their release. And I said to him that if he ate things that weren't plant-based, to just let me know. There'd be no judgment. I really needed to know, because otherwise it could screw up the findings in the study. And he said, oh, no. I'm going to eat this way. He said, I just want all the recipes because my grandmother has cancer, and I want to take our recipes and cook all weekend so I can put them in the freezer for her, because I think this will really help her cancer. So it was really touching to see that they wanted to apply this to other people. And another example of that is one night they had invited me for dinner. They created a lot of their own recipes within the parameters of it being plant-based. And we were having a discussion about food issues, and one of the young men said, you know, now that we can cook this food that really tastes good and looks beautiful, don't you think girls will like it if we offer to make them a meal? And I said, yes, I think that's the great thing to be able to offer a girl to a nice meal. And you can tell her how this food is going to make her feel, because you know now that it does make you feel better. And I think that is somewhat profound, because here's a population that's known in the literature for thoughts of date rape, and here instead they're thinking of how can I take care of a girl by feeding her something really healthful and tell her about how it's healthful.
That is so awesome. I can't even comprehend how awesome that is, Antonia.
I think it's a profound change in thinking. I really do. I think that giving back to other people, because you're feeling good for the first time, is something that really needs to be addressed at a much more serious level.
And we'll talk more about that after a short break. And Lami, did you want to say something?
I just wanted to say that it seems like you're working with a group of people who get stereotyped as being one certain way, you know, troubled youth, la, 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 la. And that I was somewhat classified as a troubled youth when I was a youth. But in my experience, you know, people, they're good people. We have goodness inside of us.
Exactly. And these kids, I loved working with them. They were very creative. A lot of my friends said, you're going to Miami and you're going to work with these big guys with tattoos all over themselves and with big knives. And I said, well, of course I am, if I'm going to teach them how to cook. But you can't cook without using a knife. And it's all about expectations. Now, mm-hmm. if I went in there terrified and shaking, saying, I'm sure you're going to stab me with the knife, then they probably would.
But and if they would I go have seen in, it, yeah.
Yeah. But I went in and I said, here's the tool you need to learn how to use properly for cooking. You need to treat it with respect. Chefs take their knives very seriously. They travel with their own knives in cases. I'm going to teach you how to properly use it. If there are any mishaps, then you're going to get kicked out of the program, but I know that there won't be. So it's the level of expectations. If you have low expectations, that's what you get. If you have high expectations, that's what you get. And when I took the students on field trips, I introduced them as culinary arts students, and the public responded very positively. Now, if I had said that these are kids from Bay Point, and anybody knew that Bay Point was the school for troubled teens, they would have responded in a much more negative way. So I wanted to really reinforce the positive with them, and I never had any problems with them. They were perfect little gentlemen. They really were very easy to work with, very cooperative, very enthusiastic, and I think they have a lot of creativity and a lot of talents that often don't get expressed.
And I'd like to talk about a couple individual students after the break.
Okay.
When we come back, just a short break. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Welcome back to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're talking with Dr. Antonia Demas today, talking about changing the health destinies of children through proper nutrition and education. I love that, how that describes the Food Studies Institute, which we'll get to in a second. Now, do you remember Lewis? I think you actually mentioned that you still keep in touch with Lewis.
Yes.
Can you, I'm going to read a little bit of his journal. Can you tell us what his life was like before coming to Bay Point?
Yes, his life was extremely chaotic. His parents were immigrants from Central America and very poor, could not really speak English. He was always in trouble. He didn't get along with his father at all. So there was a history of just dysfunctionality in the family. And he was acting out. He was stealing cars all the time and got caught and got sent to Bay Point. He was one of the students who was in the culinary program and really took it seriously and really applied it, felt totally different. One of the things I used to say to them is, you literally are what you eat. If you eat junk, you behave in a junky way. And they were able to see that. Well, Lewis really understood this program. In fact, he was the young man who was about to be released who wanted to stock the freezer for his grandmother who had cancer.
Mm.
And I've kept in touch with him. Professor T. Colin Campbell had taught this vegetarian nutrition class at Cornell, and Dr. Campbell was my mentor when I was getting my PhD. And I told him about the Bay Point Project, and he invited Lewis up to give a guest lecture in his Cornell nutrition class. He paid Lewis an honorarium for giving the lecture, and Lewis spoke to over 75 Cornell students about how he grew up on the streets of Miami, that he thought he'd spend his life trying to stay out of jail, and that was basically his main goal in life, to try to stay out of jail, because he just didn't see any options other than to continue to commit crimes. And he never, ever considered that food would have anything to do with his anger or his acting out behavior until he changed what he ate. And it just completely changed the way he thought about everything. Now, at the end of the 3.5 weeks where we were doing the vegan diet, we had a big celebration, and we invited family members and people from the community who might be interested in learning something about this work. One of the people who was invited was a recruiter for Johnson & Wales, which is a culinary college. You can actually get a PhD there, but they concentrate on culinary arts as well as some other things. They have a branch college in Miami. And this woman was so impressed with the students and the food that they prepared that she went back to Johnson & Wales and convinced the administrators to develop a special category of scholarships for these students so they could first get their GEDs and then go on and if they performed, get a college degree, which Lewis has done, and now he's working as a professional chef. But he's an example. I went to visit him a couple of years ago in Miami, and this was when he was still completing his degree. His family totally changed their whole focus. They moved to North Miami, where Johnson & Wales was, just to support his college. Nobody in his family had ever completed high school, never mind college. And his family changed their eating habits, too. They went off dairy. They discovered that they were lactose intolerant. And they just became totally supportive and so proud of their son. And one of the additional benefits was he really got along with his father after that. This was his anger had subsided, and his parents were so proud of him that it really helped with the whole family dynamic. And the family was so proud of him going to college and succeeding in this way because they anticipated that he'd be in and out of jail his whole life.
Wow, that is so inspiring. And he did say, and this is, I'm going to read a bit of his journal entry from when he was at Bay Point. I'm just going to summarize it. He said, "So they introduced me to a vegetarian diet and asked me to stick to it for 1 month. Now, I come from a different type of culture and environment, so I automatically thought to myself, I might not stick to this diet." And he goes through the process of what he learned and how much he changed. And he said, "I have decided to keep on being a vegetarian when I leave Bay Point and might even be a nutritional chef if I get a chance to."
And now he's a nutritional chance chef. And I'm very happy that he did.
Changing the health destinies of these kids. Now, you also said that you had access to their evaluations at school in terms of their incident reports.
Yeah.
Did the instructors notice improvements in these kids?
And most definitely.
Yeah?
Yeah. Everything improved. And it's backed up, fortunately, with the blood work. Because if it were just the observations about behavior or the grades in that short amount of time, some people might be skeptical, but the fact that their blood work improved dramatically also tells a pretty picture, I'd say, because the blood work you can't argue with. You know, that's really objective.
That's the science that's out there right now, yeah.
I guess
so the cholesterol dropped by an average of 15%, right?
Yeah.
And what else? What else happened to these kids clinically?
Their blood sugars went down. They lost weight if they needed to. And a number of them did. Their complexions cleared up. The main thing was the increased energy. It used to be they'd eat a meal and they'd fall asleep, and they were just lethargic after eating. But one of the side effects was they had so much energy. At first, the staff didn't know what to do with it because these kids were normally just apathetic. But they were so full of energy. That was an adjustment at first. They really performed better in sports, and one of the students was a football player, and it was interesting because in the beginning, the other students in the school who were eating the usual fare would come over and look at what my guys were eating, and they say, "Oh, you're eating rabbit food. You're going to get weak like a girl. You're not going to be strong." And the football player said, "Did you notice me on the field? I've never had this much energy. I've never performed so well in football." And so they couldn't really argue with that. And by the end of the 3.5 weeks, the other students were begging to join this study because they saw that my guys were looking better, acting better, feeling better, and they were talking about it a lot. So in the beginning, it was a stigma to be doing this, and by the end of it, it was everybody wanted to join forces.
So, I mean, better grades, better behavior, getting along better with other people, better physical health.
Exactly. Yeah. And the food, you know, as my guys would say to the other kids, "Look at your food and look at ours. Ours looks good. Ours smells good. And ours is good for you."
Right. As you know, I contacted Dr. Colin Campbell because I was researching the link between dairy intake and early puberty in girls, and then after that, between puberty in girls and increased violent behavior. And do you think the standard American diet of meat and dairy actually causes aggression in our children?
I think it's really complex what causes aggression, but I do think that all the hormones that are in all those animal products and the excess protein, you know, I think it's all intertwined. And then there's the whole family dynamic and the fact that these kids are marginalized. So I think it's really complex. But I do view diet as a major contributor. And at some point I'd like to really do a more in-depth study about this, because I really do think that food is a relatively easy solution to a complex set of problems.
And this seems like a huge topic. I'm surprised that, and this was back in 2001, the Bay Point study. I'm surprised that in the past 5 years that, as you said, I think that you said that there's been trouble getting funding and interest to do this kind of study on a large scale.
Yes, I tried immediately. I tried for a number of years to get additional funding to do it. My study came about rather organically. I didn't start out thinking this was going to be a pilot study. I thought I'd do what I was asked to do, and that is develop a culinary program for the school and improve the offerings in the meal program. However, this planning came about as I was doing it. I thought, since I'm getting such great cooperation, so I wasn't able to get a control group or anything like that. However, the results, which include the medical results, are so encouraging. I thought that that would certainly be incentive to try to get additional funding, and I tried for years, and I'm still trying. I'm not giving up on this. The resistance is there's virtually nothing in the literature that looks at this, so it's one of those really difficult situations where there's no literature, even though I've got this preliminary pilot study, but which is so encouraging and costs practically nothing. In fact, the meals that my students prepared cost a lot less than the typical meal, so they saved money by eating this way, and they were a bit extravagant in some of the things that they purchased. They got a lot of pistachios and things like that, which are expensive. But it's just one of those situations where somebody's got to say this deserves a very serious controlled study and put some funding up for it. Because I think in the short term, to do the study right would cost some money, but in the long term, the benefits would be enormous. And I'm confident that there'd be very strong data that would clearly indicate that everything improves. And everybody benefits from that.
Antonia, I just wanted to ask you a question about that, about getting funding. Do you think it's potentially almost the success of the program in the way that, like, the systems want to keep the meat and dairy industry going, and they want to keep people filtering through the prison industrial complex, and, you know, like, in a kind of systemic oppression kind of way, they almost want to keep people down so that they can keep the big machine running. Do you think that's a factor in you not getting the funding that you need, or is it not?
Oh, it's really hard to say. Again, I think there are all kinds of issues. People have their own agendas, and I've found over the years that food, I think there's a bias against looking at food, and my view is that it's perceived as trivial, it's perceived as women's work, and if women can do it all over the world, then therefore it's not that serious, it doesn't deserve real serious study. I mean, that's my sense, that there's a bias against food because it's not taken seriously. But by ignoring food in schools and with children and allowing all these products, many of which don't contain any whole foods, to dominate our cultures, we're really missing out. And unfortunately, what I spend a lot of time doing in my work is retraining people's palates, because it used to be we'd have instincts, and, you know, as animals, which we are, animals know what food's poisonous and what's not. If you set a human free and let them try to decide what to eat in a field, they'd never figure it out, the average person. And the level of food illiteracy is shocking to me. You know, kids are really disconnected from food sources. One of the studies that I've been an advisor on for 12 years is in Vermont, and it started out in two very rural Vermont schools where they're very connected to agriculture, at least one would think so. And I did a pre-survey on these students, and one of the questions was, where does maple syrup come from? And a number of these rural Vermont kids thought maple syrup came from cows. Now, if kids in rural Vermont don't know where maple syrup comes from, when it's such a big industry and it's pretty much inescapable because they cater to the tourists and everything else, then we're really in trouble.
Yeah.
Because the kids in the city are even more far removed from food sources. So I spend a lot of my time trying to undo the damage that all these chemical flavor enhancers have done and try to get kids to smell food again and taste it again and know that there's a difference between a vine-ripened strawberry and one that's been traveling for thousands of miles and grown on soil that's been completely depleted. So I really concentrate in my work on soil fertility, because if you don't feed the soil with the nutrients it needs, the plant's not going to have those nutrients. And even if it's organic, if it's not in the soil, the plant will not be able to take it up, and so you're going to be eating a deficient product. So we really have to give back to the soil. To me, nutrition begins with healthy soil.
And as I understand it, and animal farming, the more the arable land is farmed with animals on it, it continues to deplete the soil and, I guess, in essence, sort of kills the land that they're on, so they have to sort of move to new arable land. Is that kind of right?
Yes, and it also, the runoff is one of the major contributors to the water pollution, too, the runoff from farms.
And then we have to, I guess, you know, destroy some rainforest to make some new land that is rich. The soil is rich there for farming, for, you know, soy and all these other, and corn and things like that, to actually feed to the animals to then feed to us.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really dangerous in general to rely on agribusiness to produce the world's food. The small farm could be much more sustainable, and it used to be that people did have small family farms, and they would have a diversity of things that they would produce. This monoculture also is extremely dangerous for the soil, and it's not a sustainable practice in the end. So we really relying on too few farms to produce too much food in ways that don't give back to the soil or the earth.
Let's talk about your food curriculum. I think there are teachers out there who are listening to you and thinking, how can I possibly get a little bit of this into my classroom? Is that why you made your food curriculum?
Yes, yes. And I'm redoing it this summer. It's going to really show the developmental differences, too, because it's really for people of all ages. It's not just for elementary students. I've used it for all ages, including adults. And, in fact, adults, in a sense, need it more than kids because they're so confused by all these conflicting studies out there. They don't know where to turn for accurate nutrition information.
And the food curriculum, if people are interested, they can go to foodstudies.org. Is that your website?
Yes. Yes.
For the Food Studies Institute. Now, you created this institute for the purpose of, as you say, changing the health destinies of children. And this is a nonprofit organization dedicated to that.
Yes, and I founded it because I wanted to get into as many different schools as possible. I wanted to make this available in the most efficient way that I could. Most of the populations I deal with are low income, and I want to provide them with accurate information about food and nutrition.
Do you have any simple tips for parents and teachers out there to get their kids interested in vegetables and fruits again?
Yes, I do. Number one, make it fun. A lot of nutritionists kill people's interest in food by talking about food as chemicals and not food as celebration. So I bring in the cultural aspect. I make it hands-on sensory learning about math, science, social studies. So food is really the vehicle to teach all those academic subjects. It's a great way to introduce different cultures. It's something tangible. It's a wonderful way to overcome prejudice against people, because if you're first introduced to a different culture through something so positive as their food, then when you meet somebody from that culture, you're going to be predisposed to have a positive image because of that memory of the food experience. Let the kids have all the hands-on experience themselves. When the adult does the cooking in front of a child, it's not the same. So it's really critical that the child literally has a hand in preparing whatever the recipe may be. The other thing is I start with the premise that children are extremely capable. So I expect that they will understand what I'm talking about if I make it, if I present it in a straightforward way, and that they'll be capable of doing whatever the activity is around it. So, again, it's whatever your expectations are, and mine are very high when it comes to children. I also have learned a tremendous amount from children who see the world through less tainted lenses than we adults do. They have an innocence and a curiosity that, unfortunately, gets stamped out of them often in the process of schooling, and I think needs to be celebrated. They need to know that asking questions is a good thing and sharing their observations is something positive. So I really encourage the students to say what they want to, and to I listen to them very, very carefully, and I've learned a tremendous amount from children over the years.
And what I like about how you teach children, too, is that you're not just trying to make school cafeterias healthier. You're actually empowering students to make better choices at school and at home and for life.
Exactly, exactly. And one of the reasons why this is successful is there's no judgment. So I don't start with condemning them or lecturing them, saying what you're doing is wrong or you shouldn't eat this way. I leave that out. You know, nobody wants to be criticized. Instead, it's a positive introduction of foods that they are not typically being introduced to any place else. So there's a real gap in terms of introducing the diverse plant materials in the public school system. So if you keep the judgment out of it and you just make it positive about these foods, then they start asking their own questions. One of the other outcomes that has been very noticeable for me over the years is the incredible impact of children as educators of their whole family. I found that when you get the kids hooked on eating these healthy foods, they really get it. If it's introduced in the right way, which is no judgment and fun, then they go home and they have major impact on family eating habits. So kids are extremely valuable in changing the whole dietary history of their family, because these kids go home all excited. They want to cook dinner for their families. They drag their parents to the grocery store to buy dandelion greens and Brussels sprouts. It's the way the adults introduce these foods to children. Adults need to understand that it's a setup, basically, in terms of not liking vegetables. We tell them all the time, you're a kid, kids don't eat vegetables. The reward foods, if they do something that we're proud of, we reward them with high-fat, high-sugar foods. And I think we really need to assess that, because we're giving them very clear messages about foods. Also, adults are the ones who bring the foods into the house. I've had many parents call me over the years saying, my two-year-old will only eat junk. Well, your two-year-old doesn't get in the car and go to the grocery store and stock the shelves. So parents need
I guess
to
Dr. Phil would call that an enabler. Sorry.
Exactly. But I think as adults, we don't have a clear understanding of how we're setting up the kids not to like the health-promoting foods.
And I love how, so it's not just changing the health destinies of the children, it's changing the destiny of their family, and as you said, changing the history of that family for years to come.
Exactly, exactly. It's opening up the palate, which opens up the mind, and I think there's a strong connection on a cellular level as well as just a symbolic level. When you embrace diverse foods from around the world that are health-promoting, you've experienced them, they're always going to be part of your memory bank. But if you never have that experience, then there's a closeness there that's just not good.
And that's a good place to end. We're completely out of time. Antonia, I'm so fascinated with your work, and I can't wait to hear more from you. And I had 20 other questions for you, but unfortunately, it's only an hour show. So I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome, and I'm happy to talk to you again.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye.
For all the links to today's show and Antonia's work and those journal entries from some of those kids that are just a fascinating read, visit us at animalvoices.ca. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. Stay tuned for Roadrunner.